All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Epic Fail. Today we have with us Dr. Wes Deason. He is a mediator.
Well, hi there. It's great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me to be part of your show.
It's absolutely great to have you. What exactly is a mediator? I mean, what I first think of is I'm a big movie buff, so I think of like The Negotiator or, you know, somebody to come in and, you know, just make things right, make something happen.
I think you're right on there. Ah. A mediator is technically a neutral third party that comes and helps two people who are in a dispute find a resolution for their dispute. One of the really important things about how that works is, as a neutral third party, the mediator isn't there to try and advocate for one side or for the other. The mediator is there on behalf of both parties, trying to make sure that the interests of both parties are protected and pursued. And the mediator also does not come up with the solution that they impose on either of the parties.
Oh, okay. So that's a little bit different. I kind of thought that the mediator might have been like, okay, I'm going to almost like a judge, listen to both sides and kind of determine, okay, this is what, but yeah, so you kind of let the parties come to the conclusion on their own.
That's the point. The mediator is there as a facilitator to help draw out possibilities that are acceptable to both sides. So we do a lot of brainstorming, and then we do some exploration of some of those options. And in our exploration, we try and draw what actually is really important to each person. Because sometimes people will come with a position. They say, you're a real estate agent, right?
Yeah.
And so when people want to buy a house, they're going to have this position. And the position, for example, could be the house has to be professionally cleaned. I expect that that's a typical condition that people...
A very, very common condition, yes.
So if we explored that with people, we would discover actually having it professionally cleaned might not be the thing that's really important to them. The thing that's really important to them is that the house actually is clean when they arrive. They don't care if somebody else has paid for it or not, but they put the professional in there because they know that if it's professional, they've got to provide some kind of receipt. And then the expectation is that the person who's cleaning the house knows how to clean it and it's going to be done well.
Which, surprisingly enough, it's hard to, when you write that term in, to determine the quality of the professional clean, right? So I've seen it happen before where you write it into the contract, this home will be professionally cleaned, and they'll have a receipt from a company, but it's like it's nowhere near to the expectation of the buyer. So I always have to make sure that, you know, people's expectations are checked in those cases, but also being very clear is very important when you're writing up your contract too. Like what is clean, right?
Yes. Yeah. Clean is subjective.
Yeah.
You know?
So what I found interesting about what you were saying is it's Stephen Covey, I believe, in his Winning Friends and Influencing People, I believe. They talk about like negotiations and whatnot and how he says go for the win-win.
Yes. That's something that mediators are trying to achieve. And so if somebody comes with a position to the mediation, what the mediator wants to do is they want to actually try and dig a little bit deeper than that position. And they want to find out, why is that position important to this particular individual? And then you can actually explore with both parties, how is it possible that we could achieve what's really important to you if we can't achieve this particular position? And normally people are going to come to a mediation because they have a position which isn't agreeable to the other side. Both of them have positions that seem to be opposing. But what's underneath those positions might be interests that are much more important to them than how the position presents itself.
So with this, like, who would ideally be somebody that would use a mediator?
Mediation is really useful in any situation where people are in conflict and they can't find a solution together on their own.
Okay.
So I formally work as a family mediator. So I work in family law. I help people who are wanting to dissolve their marriage relationship or their common law relationship. They've decided they don't want to live together anymore. Maybe they're already separated. Maybe they're just on the cusp of separating. Maybe they've been separated for a long time. And they need somebody to help them work out an agreement that's going to be fair to both sides. they might be having conflict with each other that's so intense that they can't even be in the same room with each other. And that can be really challenging. Sometimes we can do a mediation where we're all online, like in a Zoom meeting.
Okay.
And in those kinds of situations, you can actually put people into breakout rooms and they don't actually have to be in the same meeting room. Or we can be in the same physical space and two people can be in different rooms and the mediator would just shuttle back and forth between them. And that can be really helpful because sometimes when people are in conflict with each other, what happens is the words that they use to speak to the other person, the choices that they make of their words and their phrases is very unhelpful for constructive discussion.
It's not what you say, it's how you say it.
That's right. And so the mediator can actually hear the message, and then the mediator can translate the message into words that the hearer will be able to hear.
Okay. And I suppose there's probably a lot of, especially in family and family law and family separations or restructuring, I'm sure there's a lot of emotion.
There is. People, of course, have spent a good portion of their life living with this person. They've given the best of what they have, and they feel that for some reason it's not working. So there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of disappointment. There's a lot of frustration. And oftentimes people are looking for somebody to blame for that rather than taking responsibility for it. It can make family separation difficult because they want to look for who's responsible for why this didn't work. Yeah. And in those kinds of situations, especially if there's a lot of high conflict, we really try and steer the participants away from trying to uncover who's responsible. And we're just looking for solutions. How can we make this situation better now? Because they've already decided they're going to split up. We're not there to try and figure out what their issues are with each other in their relationship. We're trying to find a good solution for going forward.
Yes, absolutely. With that, I'm sure you deal with all kinds of people, very agreeable people, and probably some people that are not so agreeable or maybe even completely unreasonable. How do you manage that? How do you make somebody kind of see the light or kind of, you know, use a little common sense when it comes to dealing with their own mediation?
So depending on the particular type of mediation, as I mentioned, I do family law. But I also really am passionate about trying to help people resolve their differences with somebody else. So I'm really more interested in talking to somebody who wants to resolve their conflict so they can build a deeper relationship with the other individual, whether that might be somebody in their family, or it could be somebody that they work with, or it could be somebody in their neighborhood. So really, you can use mediation in any particular conflict. But when people are interested in trying to resolve their problems with somebody else, they might be a little bit more open-minded than people who are separating their relationship, dissolving the relationship. So the motivation that people come to mediation with is going to speak into how much they want to try and understand the other person.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so important in any, whether it be a negotiation or any kind of conflict, is to first, again, I think that's Stephen Covey too. I think, you know, first to seek to understand, then to be understood.
This is very, very important. That if your first goal is to understand the other person, your relationship is probably going to go much better than if you're there just because you want the other person to understand you.
But realistically, that's not usually the case, is it?
That's very true. That's very true. And that's why people get into conflict.
Yeah.
You know, you don't understand me. You need to understand me. I'm right. You're wrong. Here's the goods. Right? You know, part of the reason why people have difficulty in conflict is because conflict is a little bit like an iceberg. You can see things above the water, and then there's things that are hidden underneath the water in an iceberg. And in conflict, when we communicate with somebody else, the things that we see are the actions and the words. But the things that are hidden underneath are both the motivations or the intentions of the person who's doing the acting and the speaking. And the other thing that's underneath in the iceberg is the impact that those words and actions have on the recipient.
Yes.
Right? So I will say or I will do something, and I have a reason why I want to do that. I have my motivation or my objectives that I'm trying to get across in doing or saying whatever I'm going to do. You aren't going to know why I did what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how what I do is going to impact you. The problem is that if I do something that impacts you negatively, you as the recipient are probably going to assume that I have a negative intention in what I did.
Yes.
Okay. So, like, for example, we bought a house just over a year and a half ago. I'm going to use this example because you're a real estate agent. You can probably understand why this might happen.
Yeah.
When we bought the house, we didn't really clarify in the contract every single thing that we expect to see on a property when we arrived.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And there were actually two buildings or shelters or, you know, whatever you want to call them.
Like a shed or?
Yes. One was a tack shed that was used to store horse saddles and bridles and things like that.
Oh, like a big shed. That's a big one.
Yeah. And at the end of the driveway, there was a really tiny, you know, like a guard shed. If you had a guard that was at the end of your driver or something.
Yeah, something you pay with a Canadian Tire or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It was cute. It was probably only, I don't know, 4 feet by 4 feet or something like that. It had a doorway. You could put a chair inside it. Somebody could sit there.
How big was the other one?
The other one was probably 8 by 8 or maybe 10 by 10.
Oh, that's big. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the lighter issue that we dealt with. The other issue that we dealt with is we discovered through our inspections that the septic system was non-compliant, but that wasn't part of the disclosure. And that was a huge issue. So the one that I'm talking about right now is just the minor issue that we showed up on the day of possession. Okay. And these two accessory buildings weren't on the property.
Oh, okay.
Nobody had mentioned anything about them. They just weren't there anymore. And my wife was the first one to notice it. She said, hey, where's that tack shed? And I noticed that the guard shed wasn't there on the driveway because I thought it was cute the first time that we drove up. And we actually went back to the photos that our real estate agent had taken of the property, you know, when we went to go view it. And we could clearly see the day that we viewed the property that both of those buildings were on the property. And we didn't specify in the contract, well, it must include this because, well, you just sort of expect that if something is physically present on the property when you view it and you make a deal to buy the property, that it's going to be there when you show up. And in the end, of course, it's just, is it worth, you know, a lawsuit to try and claim this back? Because the amount of money you're going to pay in legal fees just doesn't make it worthwhile.
That's the thing, yeah.
I don't know why these people chose to take those things off the property, but it had a negative impact on us. We were expecting that they would be there. And because it impacted us negatively, we actually then interpret they had a negative intention. They didn't want us to enjoy the buildings.
Yeah.
They wanted to sell them, maybe. They wanted to make some more money off of that. Maybe they felt like they were getting ripped off because of the septic system and they were losing money. And so they needed to try and make up for that somehow.
The assumption that you jumped to is that it was out of negative, not maybe it's like maybe there was some sentimental value or some
exactly
right. It could have been or just, you know, lack of insight. They're like, oh well, they didn't put them on the purchase contract, so okay, yeah, and that's perfect, and we can use them. Or little son Timmy, he has a new property and he could use one, so okay, we'll just give one to him. And
exactly,
it's always the first thought is like, they did this to mess with me personally. Yeah.
Exactly. We don't know what their intentions and their motivations are, but we assume what they are. And if we were able to uncover those, if we found out new information to fill in our gaps, we would probably end up feeling differently about why they did what they did.
Yeah. Or maybe they did. Maybe they were just being like twisted, getting the salt in the wound or twisting the knife. Maybe they were doing that. You never know.
Maybe. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a really good example there.
Now, they might also have thought, because they didn't sort of think through what the impact was going to be on us, they probably thought, well, we don't have horses. We didn't talk about bringing horses. So they probably thought, oh, they're not going to miss this. It's not going to be important to them. Or that shed at the end of the driveway. It wasn't in the contract. Nobody ever talked about it. It was never mentioned. It must not be that important to them. So, you know, we can move it off the property without any difficulty. And so they assume what the impact of their actions is going to be on us. And they go forward with them based on those assumptions. And when we make assumptions, when we fill in gaps that we have in our knowledge, that's where we can really get into trouble.
Yeah. that's definitely, and even now when it comes down to, you know, writing the contract or whatnot, and that's something I did as helping a lot of new agents in my office. That's something that I really stress. It's like, if it's not on paper, like, you gotta, like, there's no such thing as being too concise, right? Or too thorough, right? And maybe it comes from my days again as when I was a paramedic before I was a realtor. You know, just writing everything down. There's no such thing as having too much information, especially if you're passing, you know, you're passing a patient off to a doctor, and it's like, oh, but that's not, it's not for you to make that decision whether it's important or not. It's a part of the whole bigger picture.
Yeah. And so when we do a mediation, one of the things that's really important is for people to be able to tell their story. Because when people tell their stories, we begin then to uncover things like motivations and impact of actions. And then the other side hears this. And sometimes, you know, the eyes will open a little bit wider. A light bulb will go on. People will now understand new things that they didn't understand before. They'll understand how their actions impacted the other person or how their motivations were misunderstood and why that's led to this conflict. So storytelling is a really important part of mediation. It's an important part of life. It's an important part of understanding other people because we all experience life from our own perspective. And so our story is going to be different from somebody else's story, even if we're experiencing the same event. You and I aren't going to experience it the same way. It's going to be different because we're all subjective.
Yeah. And there's different personalities too, along with that too, right? Where some people tend to take things more personally. But just kind of being open to that. I find often we'll have something like that happen in a negotiation scenario where there'll be a decorative, you know, chandelier or a lamp or something that's involved in the buyer's wanted. And I've been on both sides where it's either it's going to happen. I had one where a lady moved from out east to Calgary. She didn't have anything with her. She sold all her stuff out in the east and she found this house and it was staged and she wanted everything. She wanted the pictures on the wall. She wanted, right? And it was great. So what we had to do is we kind of had to negotiate that along with the staging company that was used. But I've had it too where somebody will see like, oh, it's a nice chandelier or there's a nice armoire or something that they want included because it just fits perfectly in that house. And it might be a situation where it was like, this is, it's something that's been handed down and there's no, it's not nothing personal to this, to the buyers. It's like, this is just, it's an heirloom or something. We can't get rid of it, right? We can't sell. We could never sell it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so once people find that out, usually they're usually a little bit more like, you know, they might be a little bit disappointed, but they're like, I get it.
Yeah.
You know,
If it's attached to the wall and you don't want it to go with the house, take it off the wall before you put the house on the market.
That's what I tell people too, because you don't want it in bad taste in somebody's mouth where you have all these nice little chitchkas or designer items and they're thinking they're coming with.
Yeah.
But the best way to settle a conflict is to avoid getting into one.
Wow. If people could turn the clock back, they would do that so many times because the conflicts that people are in are just, they can be really protracted and difficult and challenging and people regret.
Once there's a little bit of push, there's, and you never know who it is, who it's going to be. You'll get the big surly looking biker guy that's the most easy going guy in the world. And then you get the little, you know, 5'3", you know, cute young woman that's like just a firecracker and is like, I'm not letting this go. I will take this with me to the death. And it's just like, oh God. People will surprise you, right? So it's always best to just exercise caution.
yeah, for sure.
But what got you into becoming a mediator? That's it kind of seems like to me like it's not even like so much like a referee, because I think there's collateral damage, or you must take on like a lot, right? Like there's like sometimes you can probably be like misdirected anger might come your way.
True. true that is possible. If people think or if they perceive that I'm on the side of the other person, they can be really angry towards me. This can happen, especially if I'm in a long-term situation with clients. So as a mediator, I also work sometimes in parenting coordination, helping parents who are separated or divorced, and they're co-parenting their children that they share with each other, and they're having difficulties with schedules or daycare or exchange or something like that, and they need somebody to be walking alongside them long-term. And our contracts are usually at least a year, because it takes a while to get to know your clients. And when the year is up, if they want to renew with you, then they can continue to do that. Sometimes the courts will order clients to find a parenting coordinator because they want those parents to work with somebody on a regular basis rather than seeing them back in court every year or every, you know, few months. That's really, really expensive. The last thing we really want to do with parents who are having difficulty co-parenting their children is have them back in court, because it's just an adversarial process.
Yeah.
But how I got involved in mediation is interesting. I was involved in a faith-based group in the 90s, and they were involved in a diversion program with the courts. And a diversion program is where an offender who's a first-time offender can sometimes be diverted from the court system into a diversion program. And so instead of going to court, they go to this program to have their offense dealt with. And it's a way of trying to keep people out of the court system if they can early on, especially because they want to reduce recidivism or a revolving door. They don't want this person back in court. They don't want them back in the legal system again. And so they send them to diversion programs as a way of hopefully bringing some insight to these offenders into what they've done. And the particular diversion program that I was involved in was a victim offender reconciliation program.
Okay.
And so the program was designed for minor property crimes, like a break and enter or theft, stolen property, damage to property, or something like that. And if they were first-time offenders and if they were appropriate for mediation, then we would meet with them individually. Then we would meet with the homeowners or the person, the victim in that particular case. And we would hear their stories and make a decision as to whether or not it was appropriate to bring these two people together. And so normally these parties would be unknown to each other. They would be strangers. And we would bring the victims and the offenders together into the same room along with a mediator. And they'd each have an opportunity to talk about what happened and what the impact of the offense was and maybe how they got involved if they were the offender. What's some of their background story that brought them into this place where they got involved in this particular offense? And then we'll explore ways that restitution might happen, where the victim would be happy if a particular outcome took place. And it was quite interesting to see some of the creative ideas that people had, things that you could never design in a court system, but where instead of an adversarial process, we have a process where somebody can take responsibility for what they've done, and we can make sure that amends are made towards the victim. So, for example, some offenders might make an agreement that they would come and mow the lawn of their victim every week for the entire summer. Other people would come and they would do some cleanup around their house, or they would do some community hours on behalf of the victim in a community place. But really, I think the greatest impact was actually bringing those two people together and for the offender to be able to hear from the victim themselves how that incident impacted the victim. And what ends up happening then is the offender realizes, oh, my actions had consequences on somebody else that I didn't even think about. Most of the time, young offenders in that particular kind of a situation are thinking, oh, these are just wealthy people and they've got insurance and the insurance will cover, they'll just pay a deductible and everything will get returned back to normal. Maybe it's, you know, just cleaning up a little bit of broken glass or something like that. But they don't realize the impact of the personal security or the safety that people experience as a result of a break and enter or damage to their property. Sometimes yes. People can't sleep anymore because they don't know who it was that came into their house. They don't know if this is a personal attack. They don't know what motivated it. And there's a lot of trauma that people experience, and offenders are oftentimes completely oblivious to it.
Yeah.
At the same time, victims also have the opportunity to be able to hear about what happened to the offender, what their story is. And they discover that most of the time offenders like this got into a wrong crowd, or they came from a broken home, or drugs were involved, or alcohol was involved, or there was just peer pressure, or maybe they come from a really rough situation and they actually just needed some money to be able to survive. And when stories like that come out, then people have a different response towards the offender. And many times the victim can actually see themselves in the offender as the offender talks about what their own story is. And the victim can say, well, I can understand why you'd feel that way. I remember a time when I was experiencing, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's a human story. It's a human scenario. And when we have mediation and we tell our stories, when people come together, what we're doing is we're actually bringing out our humanity. And when we bring out our humanity, there is a lot of identification that people can have with each other. You're a real person just like me. You have problems just like me. You have reactions just like me. And we've taken away that hiddenness of the other person being some unknown thing that we put a label on, this bad person or this wealthy person. And all of a sudden, the offender becomes somebody who had real problems, and the victim becomes somebody who is experiencing challenges in life. And it's not as simple as we thought it was when we just put labels on the other person.
It's funny, as you're sitting there talking, I'm trying to imagine myself, you know, if I was the victim of a break-in or whatnot, because it's always, you know, I'm just like, I'm the kind of person where I was like, I just want to catch them and have my way with them, right? And teach them a lesson, right? But
that's a totally normal reaction.
But it's like, and the fact that I wasn't there is what bothers me most about it. And it's just like, oh, if I was just there, if I was just, and but the thing is that, and so as you're telling me about this, I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if I could feel empathy for that person. But then again, I'm thinking about it here as you're telling me about it. I don't have the person sitting in front of me. If I had the person sitting in front of me and hearing their story, perhaps, you know, yeah, I could see myself being more like, okay, you know, like a little more empathetic.
Yeah. And sometimes when you get those offenders sitting across the table from you, you know, for that offender, all of a sudden, this is a pretty scary experience. You know, going to court can be pretty scary, but you're just going to be in front of people that are just doing their job. They're just doing their profession. But when you sit across the mediation table, you're now sitting across the table from somebody that you actually personally offended. This is the person whose house you broke into, or this is the person whose car you stole. And that can be a pretty scary experience for them. A lot of offenders will come to that mediation table and they're so nervous. It's palpable. You can see that they're responding in ways that people who are under a lot of stress are responding. And like so for the victim as well, this is a really stressful situation for them too. But again, people's guards come down because they start to tell stories. They become vulnerable. They become human beings. And all of a sudden we realize, wow, we're all humans in this. We're normal people.
I can see how that program would be good, especially because in my mind anyway, like if somebody is an offender and they go to court, once they've gone to court and experienced it, and I think this is why you'll get the probability to reoffend, is because now that process is not scary anymore, right? It's like, I've been to court, I spent some time doing whatever, you know, now it's not, you know, like, sure, what's the worst that's going to happen to me? I have to go and spend, you know, whatever amount of time in a, you know, in prison or whatever, right? It's like, if they've already done it, there's a lot of fear taken away from it. By avoiding that, you know, on the first case, a lot of these, you know, kids, especially kids that have done something stupid, it's a one-off or whatever. It's a great way to handle it. And and get them to realize, you know, their consequences of their actions, not only as it pertains to them, but how, you know, it affects other people.
Exactly. And that's one of the keys of mediation, is that people will come away and they will probably have a better appreciation for how their actions can impact somebody else. And the hope is, and this isn't just about victim offender mediation, this is about any kind of mediation. The hope is that after they go away from their experience, the next time they're going to do something, they might have a little bit more forethought about what their words or their actions, how they're going to impact that other person. Maybe they'll change what they say. Maybe they'll change what they do. And the whole idea is to try and build stronger, more resilient communities, communities that are more restorative. We want to restore our communities into something better than what we had. And we'd like to change this road towards conflict. We'd like to help people avoid going towards conflict and going towards more amicable conversation and action towards each other.
Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah, like, yeah, always better to come from it from a place of understanding. And I see that a lot. It's as you're talking, I'm thinking of different situations here as well. The one I always think about is, like, I don't know what movie it was, you know, somebody that has crazy Christmas decorations or Halloween decorations they put out, and your neighbor's going nuts because you're ruining the neighborhood, you know. But yeah, you might need mediation there too. Or on a more serious note, I had one where they eventually moved, but my clients had very noisy dogs, and their neighbors on both sides were just done. Like, they just did not. And it was no understanding. And it was like, I'm sure if, especially the ones to the one side, I'm sure if they were a little more empathetic, it would have helped. But my clients ended up actually moving to a house that backed onto a busy road.
Uh-huh.
The white noise of that road ended up distracting the dogs enough. So now that every time somebody walked past the front of the house, they weren't going berserk. It was it was an interesting solution, not a mediator solution, but it was an interesting solution nonetheless.
So the dog's behavior changed as a result of the cars.
As a result of the cars, yeah. But
that's great.
But yeah, I can see a mediation being great for neighbors in those situations, or property line disputes.
Yeah. I had a call just this week from somebody who said that they were trying to work out a contract situation with an insurance company. And so they were exploring whether or not mediation might be a possible solution for them. And one of the reasons why they reached out to me was because their original contract said, if there's ever a dispute about what's happening, rather than going the legal route, the parties must first try and seek a mediated resolution.
Oh.
This is also happening more in family law as well now. It's also happening in personal injury cases where people are injured, for example, in a car accident. Rather than going straight to litigation, they are encouraged. I think they're strongly guided, if not enforced, that they must try and explore mediation before they go to court. And it's a way of our legal system now recognizing that court isn't always the best way or the best avenue for people to be able to resolve their differences. And sometimes people want to go to court because they feel like, and they even use these words, I want to have my day in court.
Yeah.
What does that phrase mean to you when you hear somebody say, I want to have my day in court?
They want to get restitution.
Hmm? Yeah. They want somebody to hear what their issues are, and they want to get a fair settlement, and they want to be listened to.
Yeah. And then because they feel that they are in the absolute right.
Yeah. And sometimes when people actually do end up going to court, they discover that that day in court that they expected didn't turn out the way they thought it was going to.
Yes. As an experienced mediator, do you find that you have the ability to say, like, hey, like, you know, based upon my either previous experience or, you know, that's not how it's going to go. You may think that that's how it's going to go, but it's not going to go that way for you.
So in that particular case, it really depends on the kind of mediation that my clients have signed up for. What you're talking about can be considered evaluative mediation, where the clients are expecting the mediator to give some kind of an indication as to whether or not what they're asking for is reasonable.
Mm.
And most often, mediators don't go in with evaluation as a part of the deal. Most mediators are going in where I'm the neutral third party. I'm here to help each of you explore what your choices and your decisions are. I'm not here to make a decision as to whether or not what you're asking for is fair. That would be a different hat. Sometimes when I work in parenting coordination, I take off my mediator hat at one point and make it really clear to the clients, and this is part of our contract as well, that mediation is stopping now and we're starting a new process. And that new process is called arbitration. And arbitration is what you mentioned earlier. And arbitration is where I hear evidence from both parties and I actually make the decision as to what the outcome is going to be. An arbitrator is like a judge, except we're not in a courtroom, but we still listen to evidence. We evaluate the evidence. We can also include expert opinions. And then after all the evidence is presented, the arbitrator makes a decision and they must publish that decision, whether that's orally or in an email or in a written document. And in their publication of the decision, they have to make it really clear what the evidence was that they listened to, what did they think was convincing, and why did they make the particular decision that they made. So simply just working like a judge, except in a much more informal kind of surrounding. So we don't have necessarily a court reporter, we don't have a jury, we don't have lots of people that are involved, but we're just going to have the two parties and they're going to be bringing us their evidence, and then the arbitrator is going to decide. And it's a much faster process than going to court. But it has to be really clear to the clients, okay, you guys couldn't decide, you couldn't agree, so now we're shifting from mediation into arbitration, and I'm going to make the decision for you.
Wow. That's going to be a tough hat to wear too sometimes.
It's very challenging. You feel a lot of the weight of the responsibility of the decision that you're making, especially because the choices that you make are going to impact the lives of other people.
Not necessarily just the people that you're directly speaking to.
Exactly. Because if children are involved, this is going to impact the children. And really what we want to do is we want to have the best outcome for the children as possible. We're there for the children's best interests. And sometimes the parents don't see how their own actions are working against the best interests of their children. That can be really, really hard.
Tough for the people that are in those situations too, because it's you know, what do they say? When you're so close to something, it's, you know, you can't see the big picture, right? You need to, you know, take a step back. And that's, again, why a mediator or arbitrator is so valuable.
Yeah.
Also, you end up probably saving a little bit of money if you're not using two lawyers and two, you know.
Yes.
I wonder sometimes, you know, I know a couple of great family lawyers, so I hate to be saying anything negative about them, but you sometimes wonder, you know, if it's, when you hear these stories about, you know, this just being dragged out so long and people really digging their heels in and the lawyers letting them dig their heels in, it's like, the only one winning is the lawyer.
I mean, the lawyers are there to advocate on behalf of their client. So they're there to get the best possible deal that they can for their client. A mediator is there trying to help both parties resolve that. And of course, a lawyer wants to defend their client. They want to do right by their client, and they will pursue the law as much as they possibly can in order to support what their client is looking for.
Yeah.
They will get paid, whether it's resolved or it's not resolved. And mediators can work together with lawyers. Each client, for example, can have their own lawyer if they want to work with a mediator. They'll come to the mediation. Sometimes some lawyers will actually attend the mediation as well. That's not really cost effective, though, because then the clients are paying their lawyer's time as well as the mediator's time. So if somebody's looking for a cost-effective solution, the best way to deal with the situation is to employ a mediator, get a mediated agreement, take that mediated agreement back to your lawyer, or have another law firm write up a legal separation agreement, and then take that legal separation agreement to your own lawyer for independent legal advice. And that's where your lawyer will read it over and tell you whether or not your rights are being protected by the agreement that you've come up with. And in that case, you might actually end up agreeing to something that your lawyer will say works against your own best interests. But it might be something that you can live with, or something that you just think is okay.
Not important to you.
Exactly.
But is definitely maybe a financial, you know, uneven financially or whatever, but because you're okay with it, you're just like, okay, you know that this is good. If we can kind of wash our hands of it, then it's worth it, right?
Exactly. There's two other things that are really, really useful, beneficial in mediation. One of them is the privacy of the situation. So some people will choose to go to mediation because everything that happens between them in mediation is private. It's not part of court record. But if you go to litigation in the courts, everything that you own becomes a part of public record, right?
Ooh.
Yeah. So some really wealthy people will choose to go to mediation because they know that everything they talk about is confidential and private, and the public isn't going to know about it. That can be really helpful.
That can be super helpful, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah, like, somebody that's wealthy or popular or famous or whatever, you know, it's definitely could be very useful to keep some of that stuff quiet.
Yeah, they don't want to do that. Another advantage of mediation is that we will talk about issues that are important to the clients. The courts are only interested in specific issues.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the clients want to talk about something that's important to them that's not important to the courts. Who's going to get Fido at the end of the day? Who's going to get the dog, the family dog?
Yeah.
the courts don't really care what happens to the dog. They're there to talk about the big assets, right? And the courts might not be interested in making sure that the antique collection or the Star Wars games or Star Wars toys that you've got are divided appropriately.
Yeah.
You know, and in mediation, we can talk about the issues that are important to the clients, and we don't have to worry about what's important to the court.
Yes.
You know, that's not top of our mind. Top of our mind is what's important to these people that are sitting right in front of me. I'm here to help them find something that they can walk away from and they can feel like that, you know, that other person listened to me. We got a fair shake. I was able to, you know, say my piece, and I was able to be a part of the decision maker of how our situation is going to be resolved. And this is one of the big advantages of mediation, is the empowering that it does for the people that are involved. They're the ones that get to decide. And I would suspect that you would agree with me, if somebody is a part of making a decision of what's going to happen in the future, they're much more likely to follow through on that decision than if somebody else tells them what they're going to do.
100%. And if I feel like I'm heard, right, and not in such a, you know, you see these, you know, court cases and whatnot, where it's like, even if you're in the right, I've heard of stories where somebody's in the right and they're just basically told to sit down and shut up. And it's like, but, you know, I'm in the right here, you know, but it's like, but at least with mediation, it's not as well, litigious, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Word.
Yeah. No, that's great. So to become a mediator, what?
Well, it depends what province you're in and what your practice is. Mediation, like some other professions, are regulated provincially. And in Alberta, the qualifications for a mediator aren't really listed. Anybody can put a shingle out and say that they're a mediator. And so a word to the wise, if you're going to get a mediator involved, make sure that you find out what their qualifications are. What's their background? What's their experience? What their skill level? Are they certified with anybody? Does anybody oversee them working as a mediator? Do they have insurance? Omissions and, you know, liability insurance, errors and omissions. So
absolutely,
you have to be really careful. There's probably more regulation over other professions that aren't as critical than there are over mediators. But there are bodies in the province, you know, organizations that certify mediators and have a roster of people who are part of their organization, like the Alternative Dispute Resolution Institute of Alberta or Family Mediation Canada, where people, you know, sign on to those organizations because they've got the qualifications to be able to do that. So you need to be really careful when somebody says that they're a mediator to make sure that you know what kind of qualifications that they have to do that.
Yes, definitely. You want somebody qualified and experienced. So you've been doing this for, speaking of experience, you're doing this since?
I've been doing mediation for about 6 years.
Okay.
I have other professional qualifications. I worked in post-secondary education for about 20 years. So I have a PhD. So I have, my education is kind of high up there. And I have lots of cross-cultural experience, which is also really good for working in mediation, because it's helped me to understand the perspectives of people who are different than I am. So you have a way of being able to increase your emotional intelligence and your cultural intelligence. And those are all useful skills to help you understand what the other person might be thinking.
Tell me a little bit more about that, cross-cultural.
When I graduated from college, I was thinking about going into working in the church. And I had a college professor who highly encouraged me to go overseas to Jerusalem, to a particular school, to study there so that I could understand what the culture and the language and the land of the Bible was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to go there for 4 months to this particular school. And after I'd been there for 6 weeks, I decided that 4 months wasn't going to be long enough. And I ended up staying there 2 years and I did my master's degree there.
Oh, wow.
That was the first time that I really experienced what it meant to live in a different culture. And because I was in Jerusalem, which is a fascinating city, on one side of the city, you can be totally immersed in what some people might call Western Israeli culture, that's based on one particular language and a culture that sort of developed as a result of a mosaic of people coming and immigrating to the land of Israel. Or you can go across the street, pretty much literally, Ryan, you cross the street and you find that you're in a different language, you're in a different culture, you're in a different people, whether you're amongst Muslim Arabs or Christian Arabs. and you realize that people actually do think differently because of the culture that they're immersed in. And so that experience of living in Jerusalem for 2 years really helped me see different cultural priorities or facets of life that were so different from my Western Canadian perspective.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's like, you know, when you have, especially like, yeah, when you're in that part of the world where there's so many different cultures, and you, I mean, you hear about it in the news all the time, you know, about how, you know, the turmoil over there and how there's always, you know, differences, you know, of opinion really that are, you know, there's the fighting that goes on over there is definitely probably very eye-opening to how people think differently and
daily
from one another. Yeah.
Yeah. I was in Jerusalem during the first Intifada in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that as a result of that experience, I made a decision that I wanted later in life to live more overseas. And after I was married and we had three children, my wife and I moved to North Africa. We had our fourth child while we were living there, and we lived there for 12 years. And then we came back and I did my PhD in Canada for 4 years. Then we went back to North Africa for another 3 years. But it's just my love of understanding other people, understanding other perspectives, seeing how different cultures live and work, what's important to them, other languages, because language is a huge indicator of what's important in a culture. And all of those things help you understand somebody who's different than you are. And so I've taken all of these things now and I've, you know, sort of inputted them into my mediation practice. And it helps me to try and uncover what's important to somebody else and how our differences between ourselves and somebody else really make it difficult sometimes for us to get along because we don't understand each other, and try and help people come to a better understanding of who the other person is.
You have the education to back you up. And this comes with doing your research when you're looking for a mediator or looking for somebody to help you out in a situation like this, but to also have the personal experience that you've had too is pretty intense. You know, you said you went from Jerusalem to North Africa. Well, that's, you know, again, you know, an area probably that has a lot of different types of conflict that would, you know.
We lived in North Africa before the revolution started there. Revolution was in 2011. We were there from 97 to 2009. And then the 4 years that we were away, the Jasmine Revolution started in Tunisia and then spread to Libya and to Egypt and to Syria. And of course, that's what drove Syria and Yemen into greater civil war. And Tunisia is the only country that sort of seems to have come out with some kind of democratic institutions. But actually, in the last 2 weeks, that's also changed now, too, because they've got a president who has changed the constitution again on his own. And people are starting to wonder, you know, are all of the gains that they made during the revolution in 2011, are they worth nothing at all? And so there is ongoing conflict there. And sometimes that conflict comes as a result of corruption. And corruption is really hard to change. I'm talking about trying to help people understand somebody else. But most of the time, we're able to do that because people are actually civil and they want to try and make their societies better places. But sometimes you will find people that are unreasonable, people who don't want to compromise, people who don't want to try to understand somebody else, people who think they are always right. And situations like this are not appropriate for mediation because you're going to sit down and the person who's maybe the victim is going to be traumatized all over again. So you have to be really careful when you assess whether or not a situation is appropriate for mediation or not, because you don't want to re-traumatize somebody or put somebody into a situation where they're not going to be able to come to a successful agreement.
Very, very true. So what would your advice to someone be that is seeking mediation, or, you know, even before that, in conflict, right? You know, what would be your piece of advice to someone?
I would really encourage somebody to reach out to an ADR professional, alternative dispute resolution professional, somebody who works in conflict and understands conflict, because even in just talking to somebody else, getting an outside point of view could be really useful for you. You might also be in a situation where mediation might not be appropriate, or the other person might not want to participate in mediation. And that's where if you talk to a conflict professional, you might be able to find ways that will improve your situation without involving the other person. when you explore with an ADR professional, they might be able to tell you, well, this situation looks like it could be mediated, or it's most likely to have a successful outcome if the other person is interested in trying to explore this. And then you have to make a decision with them. Who's going to approach the other party? Will the person that's in conflict with them approach them and say, hey, I talked to somebody about trying to resolve our conflict, and they're going to reach out to you? Or do you let the mediator reach out to them? And that's a conversation that you need to have with that person as well, to explore what's the best way for us to try and feel out this other person, to see whether or not having a third party involved is going to help them resolve that situation. That can make somebody else explode, because they might think, why did you take our problem to somebody else? And those kinds of difficult personalities can be really hard to negotiate with, or help to see another perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. So if you're reasonable enough in the middle of a situation where you need mediation, which is probably hard enough to be that reasonable person, to expect the other person, the other party, to be as reasonable as, yeah, that's not probably the way it's going to go. Like, how do you even approach that? Like, if I'm in conflict with somebody, to say, hey, you know, we should, you know, bar everything that we just said to each other, we should go talk to a mediator.
Let's go call Dr. West.
Let's call Dr. West and go on to Dr. West's office.
Yeah. So the other party is usually somebody that feels like they're not being heard either. And really, everybody wants to be heard. You want to be acknowledged. You want people to understand what's going on for you. And when you get a mediator, even on the phone, with somebody, and you're trying to explore with them whether or not mediation is a good avenue, a really good thing that a mediator can do is just say to the other person, why don't you just tell me a little bit about the conflict? Tell me a little bit about what's going on, and express interest in hearing that person's perspective. And if I come to you, Ryan, and you're in conflict with your neighbor because they've got those loud dogs,
yeah,
I'm on the phone and you think that I actually want to hear how you feel about this, are you going to tell me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to make sure that you feel heard. That's what a mediator is supposed to do. And if you feel heard, then you're going to feel like, oh, this person listened to me. This person understands how I'm feeling. Oh, I think I might be able to trust this person. And when you can build rapport with both parties as the mediator, and then you can bring them together, that trust is what helps take you into a place where you can explore things with the parties together as to how they might be able to resolve something that's fair and equitable to both of them.
Brilliant. That's brilliant. So do you ever take and use your skills at home, or where you're like, okay, well, I want to watch my show. So, well, I understand where you're coming from, and Gilmore Girls is really important, but.
So we live in a fairly unusual home situation. I live at home with my wife and my daughter and son-in-law and their three children, and my son and daughter-in-law. My daughter-in-law is going to give birth later this month. So we're going to have 10 people. We have 9 right now living in our house, 6 adults and 3 children.
So what you're saying is that you're always well practiced. You're never, your skills are sharp.
So we're living in a community, and sometimes I have to use my skills at home to try and help other members of the family understand each other. But that being said, when you're personally involved in conflict, it's really hard to see the other side.
Yeah.
And when I'm involved in conflict, even though I'm a professional mediator, it can be really difficult for me to be able to find a way forward. I've got the skills. I know what to do. I try to get myself out of my, sometimes we talk about a dog brain and a human brain. You know, when something goes wrong and you get really emotional, all of a sudden those automatic responses that are our instincts take over, and you want to fight, or you want to flee, or you want to freeze, whatever it is. That's your dog brain. That's the immature brain that's at the center of our brain that's really closely connected with our emotions. And the human brain is the stuff at the prefrontal cortex where we make our logical decisions. And when we're stuck in an intense emotional moment, it's really hard for us to make good logical choices because we're running on our emotion. And so what you want to do is you want to get out of that emotional brain and you want to get into the thinking brain so that you can make a good decision. But to do that, you actually have to force your brain to think about something instead of being run by your emotion. And so as a mediator, I can ask my clients questions that they will have to force their human brain to think about. But when you're involved in that situation yourself and your emotional brain, your dog brain is the one that's leading you, it can be a little bit like an elephant that's, you're on top of the elephant and the elephant is raging mad and the elephant is running. There's no way you can control that elephant. And it's just going to do whatever it wants to do. And that rage and that anger will often lead people to situations where greater conflict is created by physical violence. We have to try and get people out of those situations. So when I'm personally involved in a conflict, if I can't get out of my emotional brain, it can be really challenging for me to be able to do it, even though I've got those skills.
Yeah, I have. I come from Irish parents. And so, one's a redhead, but it's like, yeah, exactly. It's yeah. If I'm involved in a conflict, I have blinders on. I'm like, I'll admit, you know, it's very hard to you know, and that's again why it's so important to have maybe the outside person to be like, hey, you know, well, let's hear what your problem is. You know, why you're upset or what your grievance is, and let's hear what the other person is, and let's see if we can have a coming together, a meeting of the minds. This is why that's so important, because
having a third party involved makes all the difference.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So if somebody needed to find you, where would they find you?
Well, they could go to my website, or they could call me, or they could send me a text. My website is understandingtheother.com, understandingtheother.com. My email is wes@understandingtheother.com. And if people wanted to reach me by phone, my number is 403-708-9807. I provide a free 30-minute consultation to anybody who's interested in my services to give an opportunity for them to see what my response might be to their personal situation and see whether or not I might be a good fit for them and to talk a little bit about what my services cost.
Perfect. Do you want? I will put all that information in the bio and in the show notes. You'll be able to find Dr. West there. And yeah, definitely, if you're looking for a mediator, definitely this is your man. it was a great interview here, because I learned a lot. Some of my perceptions have changed too, right? Like I really had no idea how it all worked. So
it's been great to talk about it. I love mediation. I love trying to help people resolve conflict, because I think that we can often find a better way than the ways that we're currently pursuing now. And if we're finding ourselves in a place of conflict, surely there's something else that we could do. We're pretty civilized human beings. But we need to spend a little bit of time listening to each other. That's really important.
That's you know, and I think that's what we're missing right now. I think, you know, we're in interesting times, and I think that what my grandpa was saying, you know, the good Lord blessed you with 2 years and one mouth.
So yeah, twice as much listening than talking.
Yeah, so it's a good thing. And coming from somebody that had the gift of gab, you know, it's true. Yeah, it's very important to hear each other out. And if we had a little more of that, I think we'd be better off. But on that note, thank you very much for coming.
It was a delight. Thank you.
And until next time, Dr. West, stay epic.
Thanks again for listening to Epic Phelan. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe, give me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Real Ryan Phelan, and visit my website at thecalgaryrealestateguy.com. Until next time, stay epic.